Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's a strange world, the banking world, that is. Just the other day, we were talking about a bank charging its big customers a fee for depositing too much money. But a customer named Warren Buffett just made a much better deal over at Bank of America. Buffett demanded and got $300 million a year just for letting B of A hang on to his cash. Now, where do I find that kind of return? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, good day to you. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, the 25th of August, and we're very glad you're joining us. Maybe it's time to give the Oracle of Omaha a new nickname, like, well, I don't know, the 500-pound gorilla of the banking world. Consider that Warren Buffett just managed to do what Bank of America has been unable to do for most of the year, reverse a seemingly relentless plunge in its stock value of nearly half since January. Today, he announced Berkshire Hathaway is investing $5 billion in the battered bank, and share prices instantly jumped. In fact, at least on paper today, it's estimated Buffett's company made a cool $1.4 billion in just a few hours. So is this really a good deal for the bank or for Buffett? Sally Herships has more.
When Warren Buffett approached Bank of America with a deal, the timing was right.
They right now have all kinds of obligations. Having money for their depositors, they need to pay all their other liabilities, and they want to be able to invest in things.
Anat Admati teaches finance at Stanford. She says if Bank of America had tried to raise this kind of money elsewhere, it could have been tough. Investors might not have been willing to pay a lot for shares in such a battered bank. But then Buffett offered up $5 billion. Admati says it's a better deal than the alternatives.
Well, obviously, they're giving up a piece of the company. They're giving up 6% a year or whatever they promised him.
Preferred stock with a 6% annual dividend and the right to buy more shares at the same price for the next 10 years. Admati says Buffett made a good deal, maybe even a great one.
He doesn't give them $5 billion for nothing. Certainly when he invested in Goldman, he got a better deal than the government got.
Buffett has ridden to the rescue before, propping up Goldman Sachs and GE in 2008. But what will Bank of America get out of this deal? How much is $5 billion worth to a bank?
$5 billion is not, I'm not going to say it's not a lot of money, but it's nothing compared to the size of a Bank of America or a Goldman Sachs.
Paul Argenti teaches corporate communications at Dartmouth.
There's the physical asset, which is money, and then there's the intangible asset, which is his name. It's probably worth more than the money he put into the investment. But the money isn't hurt, does it?
Buffett's reputation is so powerful that by linking his name to the banks, he's ensuring success in his own investment. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
It's hard to remember any CEO's retirement creating the kinds of headlines, tweets, and emotion that Steve Jobs' announcement yesterday created. Jobs was charismatic. He is an icon of the digital age he helped create, and he built one of the most recognizable and most valuable companies on the planet. And in corporate America, Jobs' influence and Apple's influence have extended well beyond the companies he founded or worked with. Marketplace's Steve Henn joins us now from Silicon Valley. And Steve, it seems an appropriate time to maybe take stock of how much Jobs influenced the way business is done outside of Apple.
Well, you know, I think quite a bit, and in a couple of different ways. Jobs and Apple popularized ideas that were imitated widely and sometimes in unlikely places. He also played a huge role personally in elevating the importance of design in technology, and that's been imitated in hundreds of products with varying degrees of success and on thousands and thousands of websites. But finally, you know, there's a long tradition in Silicon Valley of very bright people in hugely successful companies quitting their jobs to start working on something entirely new. So one of the ways you can measure Jobs' influence and Apple's influence is to track where some of their former employees went.
Okay, so give me an example of that.
Well, there are probably hundreds of examples, but one that jumps to mind is a guy named Dave Morin. You know, he left Apple to join Facebook in the early days of that company. He's a designer and helped put out some of Facebook's more important products. And then he left Facebook more recently to start his own social networking company called Path. And, you know, stories like that are kind of typical and pretty common. But there are also some more surprising examples, too. You know, outside of technology, JCPenney's just hired a new CEO, and it ended up poaching Apple's retail guru, Ron Johnson, away from the company. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in the automotive sector, Tesla, the electric car company, you know, it makes this very expensive Roadster. Well, it explicitly models itself on Apple, and people there talk about that all the time. Here's Tesla's VP of communications, Ricardo Reyes.
We very much compare the Tesla Roadster to the early Mac. It is and has been for us the trailblazer for all the great products that are on their way. Very much the strategy that Apple employed with the Mac, and then you saw whole new product lines based on that early technology.
Okay, but a Roadster is a bit pricier than a Mac, Steve, and a Mac is pricey enough.
Well, yeah, and in a sense, that's kind of Reyes's point. You know, Macs were more expensive than other computers when they debuted, but they were widely thought to be better. People bought them. The people that bought them loved them, talked a lot about them, and, you know, were really trendsetters, early adopters. And eventually, Apple created a whole series of products that were more affordable, you know, culminating with the iPhone, which ended up in 100 million pockets. So what Tesla hopes to do, what it's trying to do, is create its own automotive version of the iPhone. And it's even gone so far as, you know, imitating Apple stores and trying to hire away Apple executives.
So you just laid out a case for companies trying to capture Apple's magic. Do you think that retaining their executives could be a problem now?
Yeah, absolutely. It might just be Tim Cook, the new CEO's biggest challenge going forward.
Marketplace's Steve Henn in Silicon Valley. Thank you.
Sure thing.
Wall Street kicked off higher but ended up lower. Details when we do the numbers. I tend to think of the Arctic as a big lump of melting ice, but it's actually packed with natural resources, and it seems destined to become the next frontier to exploit. Canada's Prime Minister Stephen Harper took an excursion up near the top of the world today, and just this week Denmark laid out its Arctic strategy. Recently, the U.S. gave Shell Oil its blessing to drill off the Alaskan coast. The list goes on. And there's fear all these competing geopolitical and economic interests are drowning out environmental concerns for the region. Marketplace's Adrian Hill tells us why interest in the Arctic is heating up.
The Arctic is hot these days, or at least getting warmer. Global warming is causing Arctic ice to melt, and that melting is creating the potential for a high-stakes, big-money geopolitical battle over which countries have sovereignty over what and which companies will profit. Theirs?
The prospect of oil and gas exploration on a tremendous scale.
Charles Ebinger is a senior fellow at Brookings. He says there's also
the prospect for potential new maritime routes.
But the political and economic interests aren't the only ones gearing up for a fight over the Arctic's resources.
In all honesty, these are difficult times to be an environmentalist pushing for protection of any landscape.
Brendan Cummings is senior counsel for the Center for Biological Diversity.
There seems to be bipartisan consensus to ignore the climate crisis and proceed with drilling.
He says the Arctic faces a whole bunch of environmental issues, from new and proposed oil and gas exploration and from ongoing global warming. The best way for environmental groups to fight, he says, may be in the courts, but they've got a big battle in front of them.
I guess it takes being an optimist to say the future is uncertain. All signs are bad.
I ask Brookings fellow Ebinger for his assessment.
Do you think that the environmentalists maybe have lost this fight?
No. I don't think the environmentalists have lost at all.
He says a lot of it depends on what happens in the region, how quickly things change. As people start hearing more and thinking more about the problem, he expects environmental forces will gain momentum. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
He he's certainly not the only one who's been complaining about lack of cooperation and irresponsibility among elected officials. But the CEO of Starbucks, Howard Schultz, can put his money where his mouth is. He recently wrote an email to employees entitled Leading Through Uncertain Times. The email got traction throughout the company and also with business leaders and Fortune 500 CEOs. Schultz has called for getting the attention of elected officials with a cutoff of political donations by corporations and unions. Maybe, he says, that'll make them work harder on the problems facing the country rather than on their re-election. One of the CEOs who has now signed Schultz's petition is Maggie Wilderotter. She's CEO of the telecom company Frontier Communications and is on the line with us now. Thanks for speaking to us.
Very welcome. It's nice to be here.
What made you decide to sign on to this Schultz petition?
Well, I believe that America has been very challenged over the last 12 months. And I think all of us are concerned and worried about the country. I know as the CEO of a U.S.-based workforce company, I've been trying to do my part to create jobs, to create opportunities on our markets, to continue to invest. But what's happened in Washington in terms of the uncertainty for business, the anti-business environment, and the fact that Washington is not taking care of the issues that are important to secure our country for the long run, it's important for CEOs to make a statement. I want Washington to not campaign. I want them to do their job on a day-to-day basis.
Now, this sort of boycott has gained traction in the business world, obviously, but do you think it's going to work on Capitol Hill?
Well, I think it sends a message. I think it's a message that says, take care of business today. Don't worry about getting elected 12 months from now. Let's do the job, and if you do your job well, you'll get reelected.
That doesn't sound to me, though, that it addresses the political realities of what's going on in Washington.
Well, I think we can only address what we can control. You know, I can't control the political realities of what they deal with on a day-to-day basis, but I can control whether I decide to contribute or not to them being distracted.
There are 100 of you on the list and probably more to come. Is this independent of party lines?
Yes, it's totally bipartisan. It has nothing to do with party lines. It has to do with everybody collectively working together because we're Americans first, and that's what's important.
Can I ask which direction that you tend to contribute?
I actually contribute across the board. It depends on the candidate, and it depends on what the candidate stands for.
What would you like to hear? What do you think would make a difference here?
Well, I think it starts first and foremost with, you know, the financial discipline to come up with a budget that works for this country, where we don't overspend for dollars we don't have. You know, we can't just keep putting that off and kicking that can down the road. We have to get a balanced budget in this country.
Trying to get a response out of Congress lately has seemed an impossible task. Do you think money will talk here?
I think it can help, yes. I think if you're not able to raise the money for campaigning like you were able to do in the past, then maybe the way you really get elected is by focusing on your results.
Maggie Wilderotter is chairman and CEO of Frontier Communications. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Coming up, what's behind the move to run colleges more like a business in Texas?
For all the money that taxpayers are putting into the university, where's it going?
But first, let's do the numbers. The roller coaster continues as investors wait for tomorrow's speech by Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 170 points, 1.5%, to close at 11,149. The Nasdaq deleted 48 points, almost 2%, to finish at 2419. The S&P 500 fell 18 points, 1.5%, to finish at 1159. Apple peeled off 0.2% based on Steve Jobs' retirement plans. The tech giant had earlier been down as much as 7%. Bank of America soared more than 9% after the multi-billion dollar infusion of cash from Berkshire Hathaway. And talk about regaining your footing, Collective Brands, the parent company of Payless and Stride Rite shoe stores, stepped up 18.5% after the company announced plans to close less profitable stores. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its second estimate gross domestic product report for the second quarter. In Jackson Hole, Wyoming, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke delivers a speech on the economy. And it's a day dedicated entirely to Spot or Fido or that one cute little fuzzy puppy dog you haven't adopted yet. Tomorrow is National Dog Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ristall. Our breakdown economic coverage continues today with a look into our not-so-distant past. Our current economic troubles that began in 2008 have been compared quite frequently to the Depression of the 1930s. But how do they match up with more recent downturns? Carmen Reinhart is a fellow at the Peterson Institute and co-author of the book This Time is Different. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Technically, I know we're not in a recession, but a lot of people are still feeling like we are. What do you think?
We are in a prolonged slump, a period of subpar growth. Last year, literally to the date, Vincent Reinhart and I did a paper for the conference, the Federal Reserve Conference at Jackson Hole. That paper was called After the Fall. In that paper, we basically looked at the 10 years after severe financial crises. And the overall characterization of those 10 years is that growth is slower, about 1 percentage point slower, and unemployment is significantly higher. So that's why we kind of feel we're in a recession. We're not in your run-of-the-mill business cycle.
And, you know, this time what's different, it seems to me, is it's so hard to see the way out. So many of us are mired in debt. We have no way to make the extra money we'd need to change that. Am I wrong or are we more boxed in than ever?
No, you're absolutely on the mark. In the boom period, a lot of debt is built up, and in this case, household debt. And that unwinding of those debts is not something that happens quickly.
This malaise, if you will, how is it different than downturns in the last, say, 30 years?
Well, let me make, an apropos comparison. The 1982 recession was a fierce recession. In effect, it was the worst recession up to that point in the post-World War period. But after the economy bottomed out in the tail end of that year, we had a rip-roaring recovery by any metric. That rip-roaring recovery was in part fueled by the fact that the Fed was able to very aggressively lower interest rates. But also importantly, and this gets back exactly to the point you were making, household debt as a percent of GDP in 1982 was 45%. Household debt right now is more than twice that.
Are we less equipped to deal with this problem?
Well, it's not that so much that we are less equipped. It is that a lot of the standard recipes don't work as well. Monetary stimulus, there's only so far that you can go. Interest rates already at record lows.
Behind that question of being less equipped, last week we spoke to somebody who noted that he'd lived through three recessions, and this was the worst, he said, because our economy is less balanced somehow than it has been in the past. Not enough stuff is being made here, was his point. What do you think about that?
Well, that's a very valid point. We don't get that kickback in employment because part of the globalization process has also meant, you know, outsourcing. The job market in America has changed structurally. Another reason why you would think of imbalances, we continue to borrow from the rest of the world. And that is an issue that sooner or later comes back to bite you.
This all sounds very complicated to me, which is to say there is no easy way out still.
Indeed. No silver bullet. No, you cannot make your debts disappear as much as we would like. It's not that we're powerless. We have seen monetary and fiscal policies soften the blow, but they're not capable of delivering that really robust rebound that we had out of other severe recessions like the 1982 recession, because we're highly indebted.
Carmen Reinhart is a fellow at the Peterson Institute, and the book is called, appropriately enough, This Time is Different. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It's fast become the rule in the business world. Squeeze out efficiencies wherever you can find them. In Texas, that productivity push is going to college. The University of Texas announced a plan today aimed at getting more out of its campuses and its professors. It calls for creating a new merit pay system and a system for tracking faculty productivity. But as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports from the education desk at WYPR in Baltimore, exactly what productive means in academia is up for some serious debate.
First, a spoiler alert. If you happen to be reading To the Lighthouse, you might want to turn down your radio for a sec.
I was shocked when she fell off Ms. Ramsey.
This is Mia Carter's major author's course at UT Austin.
And it's not even her death. It's what happens after her death.
Yeah.
Like, she's already dead.
Just 14 students in sandals and flip-flops sit in a circle talking about Virginia Woolf. Carter says she likes it small.
They get to know each other and spend really good time reading together and thinking together and learning how to argue, and that's much easier in a small class.
But some critics of the university say professors like Carter aren't teaching enough students, that they spend too much time in small classes doing research or serving on committees. And with tuition rising faster than inflation, that's a luxury no one can afford.
The top fifth of faculty in terms of teaching loads are teaching an average of about 318 students per year. The other 80% of faculty are teaching approximately 63 students a year.
That's David Gunthner of the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Its offices are in an unassuming bank building a few blocks from the state capitol. But the conservative think tank is behind a growing movement to transform higher education in the state. Gunthner says if more professors taught more students, the university would need fewer teachers, and that would save millions of dollars that could offset tuition.
What we've been trying to do is to figure out, okay, for all the money that students are putting into the university, for all the money that taxpayers are putting into the university, where's it going? And what are we getting for it?
Both the Texas A&M and University of Texas systems have tried to answer those questions by publishing data on their faculty, their salaries, how many students they teach, how much grant money they bring in for research. A&M even highlighted in red which professors weren't pulling their weight. A former University of Texas consultant came out with his own ranking system last month. Those with the lightest teaching loads and least grant money at UT were labeled Dodgers. Coasters were considered only slightly better. Naturally, the faculty freaked out.
We do feel besieged here on the campus.
Alan Friedman has taught English at UT for more than 40 years. He's incoming chair of the faculty council.
Okay, so do you know how productive you are?
I have no idea. I think I'm pretty productive.
Okay, well, let's take a look.
All right.
We find Friedman in the raw data. He makes just under $100,000. Total number of students taught in the 2009 school year, 59. That would put him in solid Dodger territory. But Friedman has won several teaching awards. He's written 5 books, edited 10 others.
The fact that I've chaired almost every standing committee of the university, the fact that I'm deeply involved with many of the things going on the campus, doesn't show up anywhere.
Officials understand it's a flawed system. But as more people question the value of a college degree, it raises other big questions about the purpose of a university. Is it to train qualified workers, teach people to think, discover new technologies? Raymond Paredes is commissioner of the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board.
I do agree very strongly that we do need a proper balance among research, teaching, and service. So clearly, we need to develop metrics that measure productivity in a way that takes into account the different ways that faculty work in different disciplines.
Sounds like that may take somebody out of the classroom for a while. In Austin, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, the price of gold's been slipping for several days now, but that doesn't mean it's lost its allure. Police are investigating an armed robbery with a twist at a jewelry store in Denver yesterday. A pair of suspects dressed as clowns apparently thought they were cleaning the place out of its precious metals and gems. But since prices have skyrocketed lately, it seems what customers get to see in many jewelry stores is actually a cheap sample, an imitation of what you can order. So the Denver store owner says what was taken was basically worthless. Bottom line, a couple of fake clowns got a bunch of phony jewelry. And that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 170 points, 1.5%. The NASDAQ deleted 48 points, almost 2%. The S&P 500 fell 18 points, 1.5%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Hawes, Patty Hirsch, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for our latest breakdown coverage, The Economy One Step at a Time. Next time, right here, what can happen when the power goes out in China?
We run 24/7, and when we are suddenly cut off, that means people have to go home.
Well, I'm going to go home now. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow, and thanks again for joining us today. This is APM, American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.